We're back with you on the Sports Leader, Dieter Kurtenbach, until 10 p.m. This is the Giants Hot Stove League show, and we're talking to our good friend Eno Saris of The Athletic about all things analytically inclined and beyond in the world of baseball. We're always happy to have Eno's insights. He does it like few others in this weird game that we like to talk about and play. Eno, how you doing, man?
I'm doing good. I wish I wish that we had a CBA and that everything was hunky-dory between the players and the owners. But I actually am a little bit more optimistic than some. I think they're starting to speak the same language, and I think we might have an agreement here soon.
Well, that would be absolutely fantastic, because the best analogy that I had going, and please correct me if you think I'm wrong here, was that it was very similar to like March 2020 when we're like, it'll just be a month or so. It shouldn't be too much of a problem. And then here we are a long time later, and it didn't get much better. But if I were to make you commissioner for a day, and obviously there's a lot of billions and such that are being ballyhooed about, but there's also some rule changes and some structural changes, maybe or not, to free agency and the like. But what is sort of your single issue that you're hard about? Like, if you were a single issue voter on any of these topics that are on the table right now in these CBA negotiations, what would you classify yourself as in that camp?
I think it would have to be the minimum salary. I think there has to be a huge change to the minimum salary. Right now, if you look across baseball, over half of baseball is playing on the minimum salary. And, that minimum salary is also lower than it is in other sports. So what you're seeing is also a minimum salary that has not gone up commensurate with the changes in revenue in the game. So, for example, since the last CBA, baseball went from a $7 billion sport to an $11 billion sport. And in that time, the minimum salary went from $500,000 to $560,000. So, they're not changing on the same level. So I think a huge jump, like I personally think a $1 million minimum salary would change so much about the game. Because if you think about it, now you're starting to talk about like, hey, do we get this older veteran that we know is projectable, that we kind of know he has a track record, we know what he might do next year. Do we pay him $3 or $4 million, or do we take three shots at three kids that are going to be $1 million each? And you'll start to see, I think, some more middle class veterans being signed, because they say, you know what, instead of not knowing what we have at shortstops next year, we're going to sign Freddie Galvis, or we're going to sign one of these older guys.
Well, and it makes so much more sense to just go with six or seven of those young guys if that's really the math that we're doing. It makes a whole lot of sense there for a team to do it. And the weirdest part for me, and I've rallied about this for a long time when it comes to the players' union. I know that it's sort of all classified as this good versus evil, and I totally understand where most people are coming from on that. They think that the players are the little guys, but if this was their union, I think they'd be livid with the way that their union treats them and the rank and file. It doesn't seem as if there's going to be much movement when it comes to the minimum salary, but damned if they're not going to fight tooth and nail to raise the competitive balance tax threshold, of which like three teams are really involved in that on a yearly basis. So it seems to me as if they don't really care about the low level guys or even the mid level guys. They just care about those guys who are going to make $250+ million a year. And that's unconscionable to me. Do you see it the same way?
You know, it's a dirty little secret. And yes, you know, we're all sort of required to take sides, it almost feels like. But the dirty little secret about this union, this baseball union, that actually makes it different from other unions, and I can't actually speak to other sports unions, but in terms of other unions across the landscape, when you get a tentative deal with ownership in most unions, everybody in the union votes on it. In baseball, that is not the case.
Wow.
In baseball, only the executive committee, that's a bunch of players like Max Scherzer, and like they're well-intentioned players,
no
but
doubt.
They are usually veterans that made it to free agency, made a bunch of money, and have the respect of their peers. And then the reps from each, so there's 30 player reps from each team. And again, a lot of times those are veterans that made free agency. And the thing is, the average baseball player doesn't make free agency. He only makes it 3 years. He gets the minimum salary for 3 years, and he's done.
Right.
So if you're being led by players that are that have made it to free agency, they think, oh, everyone makes it to free agency, so therefore we need the NLDH. That's more free agency jobs. We need the CBT. We need all these things. And they don't necessarily focus on the minimum salary. Now, all that being said, what I've seen in the proposal is a $775,000. That's coming from MLBPA. That's the new minimum. That would be one of the largest increases in the history of their negotiating. So I do think, you know, and you hear Max Scherzer saying things like, we need the young guys to get paid. We need people to get paid earlier, and we need the minimum to be higher. So they're speaking the right language, and I do think they care about it. But it is this weird thing about the way the union is structured in baseball.
Well, that's great insight as we talk to Eno Saris of The Athletic. And listen, that's Max Scherzer. You know, he went to the University of Missouri. He always cares about the little guys, Max Scherzer. So not surprising hearing it from him. All right, let's pretend as if none of this is happening and that we're just getting into the season, right? We're starting to get a little bit excited. The stove is still on somewhat of a medium heat. And, you know, guys are getting signed, but it's not the big guys anymore. I'm looking around at some of the free agency names. And as it pertains to the Giants, it's pretty clear that they're not going to go for, like, a super big one that still remains because there's just not that many of those. But when you think about the Giants and kind of what they're looking for, they probably need another bat for the outfield. Wouldn't hurt to bring in an infielder. And a number two starter, which is obviously of a certain threshold that maybe I might have just overstated in terms of not giving out some serious money. But they definitely need more starting pitching. Are there any guys that you just sort of have your eye on, guys that are sort of your dudes, right? Everybody kind of picks a couple of their dudes every offseason that you think could be a good fit for the San Francisco Giants when all of this ice thaws?
Well, you know, one of the problems is that, you know, there was such a free agent frenzy up front before the lockout that what remains is you can say, oh, there's Trevor Story still out there. Carlos Correa still out there. Carlos Rodon still out there. The problem is those are kind of almost like figureheads at the top of the, at the top of the free agent market, and there's nothing below it. You know, the second best, you know, Carlos Rodon is the best starting pitcher out there on the market. The second best might be Tyler Anderson, who was was a Giant one. You know, like
it shows how much they like Tyler Anderson.
So and then that might actually work for them if they just want depth, they just want innings, and they're hoping, you know, for a resurgence. You know, another year from Logan Webb, and he's their ace, and you know, but do you see Kevin Gausman to Logan Webb on this roster? Do you see it out on the free agency market? Not necessarily. It's like if they want to go big, they can get Rodon. He might cost like $480,000, and it wouldn't cost as much as Gausman did, and maybe that's what they're going to do. What I do wonder about generally with this, because I think Trevor Story or Carlos Rodon would make sense for this team, is I'm waiting for the Giants to spend.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like you know, Farhan came from the Dodgers. You know, they spent a lot. And I'm just and the Giants have money under whatever the tax is. They have money to spend. And I keep waiting for, you know, I'm not saying they haven't spent at all. They've done some extensions. They brought back. I like the Alex Cobb signing. You know, I like their sort of depth approach. I like their little signing. But I keep waiting for like the where's your headliner? Where's your A1? When are you guys going to actually sign a big name?
Do you think that this is an overarching indictment at all, or maybe it's just a Farhan thing of sort of the quote-unquote, I hate doing this because you know I don't think this way at all, but like the analytically minded front offices, of which it's like 25 teams in baseball right now, that they're so inclined towards the term value that they don't go out and sign guys to these massive deals? Or do you think that that's a complete overstatement?
I mean, I think it's a valid criticism, dude. If you look at some of these teams, they just will not sign a long-term deal. And it works for them, right? Because long-term deals, they're post-peak. You know, you can understand why it makes sense. But 100%. The Giants have money like the Dodgers and Yankees. You know, that's where they belong. And when you're the Dodgers and Yankees, you do actually have to make some of these signings where you're like, hey, year seven is deal, not going to look pretty. But you know what? By that time, we'll have some other young guys that will come up. He'll be our DH or he'll be our backup, and it won't be that big a deal. I thought for a while that like Chris Bryant might make sense like that. Maybe they'll trade for like a Craig Kimbrell, where they're expensive in the short term, but they don't have the long term money.
That's
kind of
where
to pay,
I'm at. Like, throw some short term money around. Like, what's the problem with overpaying on a short term deal? I totally get the not wanting to give someone a 10-year contract, a 7-year contract, a 5-year contract. My stance on when we've been doing these Giants Hot Stove shows over the last couple weeks is pretty simple. Throw way too much money at a relief pitcher for 2 years. Like, if you spend some money, tell us, hey, you know, we're putting some cash on the table. But like, I'm cool with overpaying some relievers. You can never have too good of a bullpen.
How about Carlos Rodon for 3 and 75, right?
Do it.
Then you're not locked in that long.
Yeah.
If he gets hurt in year one or year two, you're not waiting around forever. You're just like, okay, yep, he's there for a year, and then we're out of it. So
yeah.
I mean, yeah, there could still be, you know, and Trevor's story is interesting to me because he's not gonna get the 10 years that Carlos Correa is gonna get.
No,
so
sir.
maybe they say, hey, 5 and 125 or something for Story, and you're like, well, where does he fit? It doesn't matter. You know, play him in center. You know, play him in center, play him at third, play him at second, wherever. You know, this is the one nice thing that I like about what Farhan's done is that, like, they can sign anybody, right? Like, you know, at this age, I mean, I Crawford is, you know, he has a lot of stature, but at this point, I think almost anybody, you could move them if you had to, you know, like, you got these pieces that move around. So I think Story, if you asked me earlier and I kind of waffled and got out of it, but I do actually think Story or Rodon would make sense because they're not going to be the long-term deals and they could throw some weight around and up the AAV and get them for a shorter deal.
The countdown is on for the 2024 NFL Draft, presented by Bud Light, live from Detroit, and you can attend in person for free.
Welcome to the
See the next NFL stars and experience the ultimate NFL fan festival featuring live concerts, interactive games, player autographs, and more. The NFL Draft, presented by Bud Light, April 25th through 27th. Visit NFL.com/draft access to register for free entry today.
What's the deal with Story? Because what seems fairly clear over, let's say, the last two seasons, maybe even beyond that, was that he has sort of fallen from grace, clearly to the point now where the chasm between him and Carlos Correa is massive in terms of what they're going to get and certainly the term that they're going to get. Why has the market soured on him so over these last couple of years? It can't just be, oh, he's a Colorado Rocky, because people were talking this guy up a couple of years ago, and he was still on the Rockies.
You know, with the advent of StatCast, we have all these directly measurable, you know, statistics about, you know, athleticism. And so, you know, we used to always have, you know, stopwatches and scouts, and we had that. But now we know, for example, through StatCast, that his sprint speed has, you know, kind of tanked the last couple of years, and that his throwing arm, that he used to be a 95-mile-an-hour arm, and now he's kind of like an 80-mile-an-hour arm. So, you know, I think the question that every front office is answering differently is he a shortstop? And I'm saying, you know, the Giants might be uniquely inclined to not care if he's a shortstop.
Totally.
And I think that he still has enough athleticism. You know, I see, you know, Steven Duggar's great, but I think if you put Story out there with Duggar and made Yaz more of a corner outfielder, that outfield hums better, if you ask me. And then you're adding a legitimate bat.
Is this a possibility just on the basis of the universal DH coming? Like, does this change? How about this? Here's a question I've been wanting to ask somebody, and you're a perfect person to ask it to. Are there any teams that come to mind when it comes to this universal DH, which is unquestionably coming down the pipeline? That's like the one thing that's been agreed to at this point in CBA negotiations. Are there any teams that seem particularly well-suited for, you know, going into this new universal DH rule in the National League, and any teams that feel like that's going to put them in a tighter bind than they already were? Do any names like that jump out to you, or is this just a universal, more or less, good for everybody?
You know, I think Darren Ruff is a name that I think of. You know, he's an obvious, you know, DH type. And I think older teams like the Dodgers would benefit from it. You know, Max Muncy sliding him over to DH would make sense. But the way that I see the Giants benefiting from this is that you know that Farhan is really, really good at getting stuff out of the margins and to like and waiver claiming and finding guys, you know. And with the DH, it's just one more place that he could stick one of these waiver claim bats, you know.
Yeah.
How did we get Darren Roof? You know, how did we get Donovan Solano? How did we, you know, all these guys that he's kind of claimed over the years, DH would give him one more chance to stick them in the lineup and to find, you know, find that geometric equation that like, that kind of like, oh, you know, if we get this guy, then we can play this guy in third sometimes, this guy at second sometimes, he can DH sometimes, you know, it's like
right.
that extra use for all these little parts he's putting together. So I think Farhan would shine with a DH, I think.
The Rockies would be their situation would be really interesting, right? Like they're already playing in just this absolute, well, it's not even, it's actually a huge park, but just because of the altitude, it's a bandbox. They got the humidor going, and now every team's bringing in a DH, and they're not going to, I mean, they'll have one, but like I can't imagine that they're going to have some dominant DH just given the way that that operation is going. They might find themselves behind the eight ball, but there's no question. Farhan would do an incredible job. Sorry, I interrupted you there.
No. I'm interrupting you. I agree. That's a fascinating one. I'm writing right now a piece with Nick Roque at The Athletic where we're working on how to fix the Rockies, and we're talking to different executives.
How long have you been working on that one there, you know?
Really long time, actually.
I bet.
Yeah. And one of the executives I interviewed for the piece said, lean in to Coors, bring back the Blake Street Bombers, you know, and just out slug everyone and just have the like win 10-9. And if they have the DH, that might allow them to do that. But that is not how they've been working. I mean, if you looked, their offenses have been pretty bad away from home and to some extent papered over by Coors Field. So, That would be a departure from how they've been running things, but I think it might be an interesting one. I would love to see the Blake Street Bombers back. Giants fans might not.
Well, hey, listen, that's the trade-off. It is interesting because I think a lot of people in San Francisco and the Bay Area made sort of the argument for the Giants when Farhan first came around, like, lean into the ballpark. You can't hit home runs. Everybody's hitting home runs. Maybe you can zag when you're zigging. And the Giants somehow found a way to make that ballpark look small last year by leading Major League Baseball in home runs. Obviously, the same sort of zag has not been working for the Rockies and their sort of concept of finding guys who can throw in altitude. While Noble, in its pursuit, not exactly great in its execution. We're talking to Eno Saris of The Athletic. While we're on the National League West, I don't think that this got a lot of run over last year. Maybe I'm just not looking in the right places. But what the hell happened to Cody Bellinger? And do we expect Cody Bellinger MVP to ever really return?
I saw some slight resurgence in his batted ball data last year. He was able to hit the ball a little bit harder and you know, barreled the ball a little bit more, had more exit velocity near the end of the season. And I think it's mostly because of his shoulder injury and the shoulder surgery that he had the year before. So I do actually think he could have another, I don't know if it's going to be MVP level, but another really good season in him when he gets a whole off season to train like he normally would. So I think that, you know, the Dodgers are one of those teams where you're like, is it done yet? are they over yet? And then they come back and you're like, dang, they're projected to be like the second or third best team in baseball. And you're like, oh, sweet.
Yeah, that sounds about right, man. I mean, they have an incredible operation down there. I know no one up here likes hearing about it, but it's like, that's the model. And I think the cool part about where the Giants are is that they can replicate that model almost to a T, and then we'll see, you know, the tiny margins that can separate. Of course, then there's also the San Diego Padres, which I don't think are applying that model per se, but they have a lot of really quality players, and they dramatically underperformed last year. Do you expect a Padres resurgence given the shakeups they've made and Bob Melvin going in down there, or is it, you know, just same old Padres and what happened last year is perhaps to be expected moving forward?
I think player development was one of their main flaws, and I think it's going to be a really hard thing to turn around in 1 year.
Okay.
And I know that they made a lot of fires and hires, and they're definitely changing things in player development.
Yeah.
But at the same time, like I said, I don't think it's something you turn around in 1 year. So basically, I think the Padres are going to go in terms of their luck when it comes to health. So if you look at that rotation, you say, okay, if Yu Darvish is healthy, if Mike Clevinger comes back healthy, if you know, if everyone's healthy up to 1 through 5 in that rotation, then they have a really good rotation. If Fernando Tatis stays in one piece all year, then they have at least, you know, a good 2, 3, 4, 5 in the lineup. So, you know, I think it really comes down to luck in terms of health for them. Melvin will run things a little bit differently, and I respect the heck out of him. I think he's one of the best managers in the game.
No question.
But I also kind of personally think that managers, their number one role is to inform everybody of the lineup, like sort of keep everyone informed, keep everyone on the same page, keep everyone happy.
Right.
But I don't think they're making that many decisions these days. I think most of the decisions are coming from up top, and they can be involved in them, but they're kind of the mouthpiece for the front office more these days. So, you know, if there is a flaw, and there are some flaws in the way that, you know, we had a big story on it with Ken Rosenthal in The Athletic, that there are some flaws in the way that A.J. Preller communicates in his squad, in his front office. And if he doesn't kind of rein some of those in, I think it's just about luck then for them.
Well, I do think that there might be something, and I read a great article by Matt Obernauer in Baseball America, I believe, about culture being sort of the next frontier, as if it should, as if it ever.
Yeah.
It was a great piece. Certainly the Giants credit a tremendous amount of their success last season and their improbable 107 wins to culture. Just as somebody who it's almost a personal question here, as somebody who is, you know, championed the numbers for so long, is it strange to be on the winning side of things where now everyone is trying to figure out how to add culture into the numbers because that's just the way things are going?
Yeah, numbers are the prerequisite. I mean, there are definitely differences in R&D departments, and some teams are more into biomechanics than others and so on and so forth. But I 100% agree. And if anybody wants to see why I think that the Padres culture is problematic, I wrote, you know, a 3,000-word piece with Ken Rosenthal about
That's right.
it. And I don't think that there's no similarity between the way the Padres are run culture-wise and the Giants are run culture-wise. There's absolutely none. And some of this does go back to Sabian. And some of it does go back longer than just Farhan. I mean, there's been a culture of creativity and communication that's been in the Giants organization for a long time.
Yeah.
And they are technologically ahead of a lot of teams because of things that Sabian did.
Yeah.
So, you know, and technology and culture go together, because if you have a good technology that keeps everyone on the same page, and that's what the Giants do, then everyone, nobody steps on each other's toes, because they checked the software and they saw what everyone else said to that player, and they don't step on each other's toes. And even though there's three hitting coaches, everyone knows is on the same page, you know? So technology can aid culture. But culture is hugely important.
That's a great point about Sabian. I mean, you don't win 3 World Series titles with a crap culture. You just don't do it, especially in the improbable manner in which they did that. And it's so easy to forget because, hey, the Farhan experiment was big for the Giants at the time that it was made. And it has, to this point, delivered to whatever extent I think you would put upon it. Like, it hasn't brought a World Series ring, but it doesn't feel out of the question in any way, shape, or form moving forward. You know, it'd help if they spend a little bit of money, but clearly Farhan took over from a not terribly decrepit situation. This wasn't a tear it down to the studs and rebuild situation when it came to the culture of things. One last question for our friend Eno Saris of The Athletic. If I'm looking for like a light IPA, what should I be drinking right now? What do you got in mind for me?
Well, I'm actually currently in the Safeway aisle, and I can peruse. The one of my favorites is a hazy little thing from Sierra Nevada.
Yes,
available everywhere.
Yep,
super easy. It's available at the ballpark. But another one that's really good is Lagunitas Daytime.
Yes.
That is a crusher. And
it is fantastic.
It is so good and underrated and not expensive. Looking at a 12-pack here, I think, for $10. So.
What are we talking there, like 3 carbs on a daytime?
Yeah. Yes.
It's oh, boy.
Oh, man.
That's the quality.
I'm looking at that right now. 98 cal, 3 carbs.
Yeah. Trust me, when you're a big boy like me, you know exactly how many carbs are in all of those beers. Eno, we'll let you get right to those daytimes because that sounds absolutely delightful. I will wait a little bit before I start getting into mine because there are some in the fridge right now. That is a guarantee. Thank you so much for taking the time, and let's talk again. Well, hopefully after the CBA is ratified, but regardless, in the not-too-distant future.
Yes, thanks for having me on.
Eno Saris, who, by the way, he was being modest there. Eno is like America's foremost expert on beers. Anyone who follows him on Twitter, which I do recommend doing, unless you're not on Twitter, in which case, please don't start now. As a chonky boy who does need to take a good note of the carbohydrates that go into every beer, you know, every now and again I let it loose, but if I'm just going to have a couple beers, I'm not in the position to be adding any extras. So very big on the carbs. I'm not a guy who does the carbs all that well. And so I'm all about the daytime, but man, I look at his Twitter feed sometimes. It comes across on my phone, comes across on my laptop, and I'm just thinking, you lucky son of a gun, that looks delightful. So you'll get some really good beer recommendations from Eno. Oh, and by the way, top notch, legitimately, you know, elite baseball analysis in a manner that's well beyond the norm. You got a little bit of a taste of it there. When you get Eno really going, maybe you get a couple of those daytimes in him, that dude can break things down in a way that I have found him to be such a wonderful resource throughout the year. So Eno Saris of The Athletic, he is enough reason alone to subscribe to The Athletic, but you should already be subscribed. You listen to this radio station. We have like a dozen people on from that site, seems like every single day. The Giants Hot Stove Show will continue, or not. No. let's cut it right before that part, and we'll just do this real fast. The Giants Hot Stove League Show will continue. We'll have on Mark Simon from Sports Info Solutions on the other side of this break. Kurtenbach with you until 10. Hot Stove League Show until 8 on The Sports Leader.
Named one of the best personal finance podcasts, The Stacking Benjamin Show with Joe and his friends makes financial literacy fun.
Work hard and save your money. That way, when you're old like me, you can buy the things that only young people can enjoy.
Squirrel watching.
You heard it here first. Get yourself a squirrel cam. Spend $30 a month on nuts, and you'll be at early retirement before you know it.
No, Piggy, this is the road to a podcast nobody listens to.
Find out more by searching The Stacking Benjamins podcast wherever you listen.